Okay, Ron, thank you so much, and welcome everybody into my dining room. And we're sitting here around the table, and it's me and Ronnie and Lori tonight. And those of you that choose to join us by the way of Pal Talk. And we have been in the Song of Solomon for, this will probably be 2 months now. This is the 8th study that we're doing on this short book of the Song of Solomon. And I kind of labeled it the mind of God concerning David and Solomon. And we started off about 2 months ago talking about, I believe it was the 79th chapter of Psalms. That was the last prayer that David offered up to God, and it had dealings with his son Solomon that was to take over and get involved with the affairs of the children of Israel. And of course, God had given Solomon wisdom. And along with that wisdom comes, you know, other stuff too. And of course, Solomon was going to be king, and we found out here in the Song of Solomon that his mother, Solomon's mother, passed the crown on to Solomon after David evidently had died. And so we've taken up this love story, if you will, and it is a love story, and this is going to be chapter 7 of the Song of Solomon, and this is, of course, the 7th day of March 2018, and we're going to take up with this love story, and I hope, you know, you guys have been with me the whole time, but if you haven't, they are 8 different ones that speak in this Song of Solomon, and I've tried to do it kind of like if you went to New York City and went to an opera house to take in an opera, and you didn't really know what the opera was about, then when you went in, they would probably give you what they call a playbill or some kind of directions that tells you what each thing does and what it represents, because you might not be able to keep up with the nature of the usage of the language that they might use in it, because some of it might be written in something that you didn't know or understand. But in the Song of Solomon here, it's about a young lady that evidently her father was dead, and she had brothers. She was a beautiful young lady, and sometime or other in her late teens, about the time she got grown, she met this shepherd boy, and they kind of fell in love. And so he was tending his flocks in the pasture areas, and he had a tent down there that he stayed in, but they met under this tree and got to know each other just in conversation, I guess. But anyway, the brothers found out about it. They didn't like it too well because they didn't want her marrying a shepherd boy, but they thought that she was worth a little more than that, that, you know, maybe the shepherd boy couldn't give her the things that maybe the guys were looking that she should get. And so they sent her off to their vineyards to tend the vineyards. And guess what? Solomon showed up in that town, and he saw her, and he fell in love with her. And so that, and they had already kind of sworn to each other that they would become man and wife one day. And so the story began, and this story was read now every year at the Feast of Passover, which we normally know as Easter time. That's neither here nor there, but that was the time, you know, just shortly after the Passover, when they crucified Christ. You know, that was...
I know emphatically it's Easter at Mountain View Baptist Church.
Okay. So, we know what... we know what denominationalism looks at it as anyway. So, but anyway, this thing is either enacted or it's read by someone or something during their feast times. And there's five feast times. There's the Feast of Passover and then the Feast of Pentecost. And then you got the other feast that deals with the crops and basically a Thanksgiving time and all this. So, but this Song of Solomon was read, and that's, I think that's the reason it's in Holy Writ, because God said, you know, you teach this during this feast time. And the book of Ruth was written during, the book of Ruth was read during the time that they met at Pentecost, which was 50 days after Passover. And so, this is the basis as to why we have the Song of Solomon. And Solomon tried and promised her that he'd make her a queen if she would come and take up with his group of, his entourage that he traveled with whenever he left the palace and went out to different parts of the outlying realms. And so in chapter 7, this is going to be Solomon's last chance that he's going to get to woo her with his wit. And it didn't seem like he had a lot of wit to begin with, but now he's cranking it up a notch or two in chapter 7 of the story. And she's going to deny him again in chapter 8, but he uses a lot of imagination here in chapter 7, or a lot of experience that he's had, because he's traveling with 80 concubines and he's traveling with 60 women that he's said that are his wives. So he's got 140 women that's moving around with him, but he's wanting this girl, and he's like he's going to make her one of his top queens, you know. And so when he gets to talking to her here, with his flatteries, because he's went through some of the flatteries, and he used the words that she used about her lover when she was talking to the women that were in Solomon's group. And he thought, well, you know, since she used them, he might use them. But he didn't get nowhere. So now he's going to do it himself. Now, I want you to think about something before we get started tonight in our study. And there's two or three things. And one thing that humans have problems with is their responses or their senses. And it's hard sometimes for people to understand the difference between anger and hate. Anger and hate. You know, you ask me, well, Cecil, why are you saying this? Well, that's two responses that man has or woman has. And anger is when you can control what you're thinking. But hate gets to a point to where hate takes over. It's the old man in its essence. And the old man will cause you to do things that you might regret the rest of your life, or it might cause you to lose your life. And the same thing goes on the other side. I'm going to give you, that was one hand, now I'm going to give you the other hand. And the other hand is the difference between love and lust. And a lot of people enter into marriages thinking that lust is all they need to take them where they need to go down through their life, and there's no love involved. Well, that don't last very long. And so true love and lust has to be differentiated. Because you can love somebody and have lust. But it's awfully hard to have lust without love. Because that's not going to last very long. Matter of fact, it never works. And when I used to be magistrate of this county, they would people come to me to get married. They'd want to get married. And my cousin was a probate judge out at Walhalla, but he was also a contractor, a building contractor. And he was one of my contractors that I did work for. And a lot of times I would go out there, and Johnny was a hard guy to keep up with because he had two or three jobs going on. And to make a long story short, I would sometimes go out there on Friday afternoon, and all these people would come in because we lived in the corner between Georgia and South Carolina and North Carolina and South Carolina. And these people would come out of the other states and come here and get their marriage license, and they would come back here to get the probate judge to marry them. And sometimes I'd go out there on Friday afternoon to get paid for a job that I did for him as a contractor. And he'd say, Cecil, wash your hands, put on the robe, and help me get these people married and then I can get out of here. And I'd say, okay. And I can't remember how many I did. Didn't do all that many, but there was occasions that I did five or six in one afternoon. And whatever they chose to give me, he'd say, put it in your pocket, keep it. And so a lot of times I could make as much off that as I made running my business all day. Okay, so having said that, you know, I would tell them. And I'd say, okay, get married, kids. Most of them were young people. I said, get married, kids. They like going to the bank and opening a joint bank account. And I said, you can't expect the two of you to take something out of this account if you don't regularly put something in that account. Because it's like a bank account. If you draw all your money out, they'll tell you there ain't no more. And so that's kind of the same way it is with a joint bank account. And marriage is a love account. So if both of you don't put love in it, then how's both of you going to get love out of it and keep it going? And I just explained it that way. And so they thought about it. I think all of them thought about it. And they left out thinking that I was a smart dude. And which I wasn't all that smart, but maybe that helped them somewhere down the road, because I had experience with me and my wife that we both put into that marriage, and I knew we both could take out of it and it would still be solvent. It would still be something there that you could draw from all the time. And the Lord gave me that understanding.
Amen. That's the way the correct ones work.
Amen. So we're going to start in chapter 7 of the Song of Solomon. And it's on page 923. If you have no, it's a little further over. I've done turned my pages back to the first part of it. It's on 927 of the Companion Bible. Now I'm going to start, look back up at chapter 6 and verse 13. And this is Solomon talking here, where it says, "Return, return, O Shulamite." That's what the young lady was. She was a Shulamite. He says, "Return, return, that we may look upon thee." And every time in the Old Testament that you look, and when God calls, or somebody calls, somebody of authority calls somebody else, and it uses their name twice, or uses a word twice, that is done for emphasis. And if God does it, and he calls your name, and he calls it twice, you better answer him on the second call, or by the second call.
Saul, Saul, why persecute us?
Amen. So he says, "Return, return, O Shulamite, return and return that we may look upon thee." And then the Shulamite says this next question. She says, "What will you see in the Shulamite?" She says, "If I turn around to you, tell me, what are you going to see?" Starting in chapter 7, verse 1, he does that very thing. And this is his imagination now, because he's never had any real close relationship with this lady. It's always been arm's length or further. But now he's using his imagination. And man's imagination can play tricks. But now he's got all these other women that he's dealt with, so he knows how it goes. And so don't have a red face with this, but because this is getting down to what he sees in this young lady. Okay. He says 7:1. "How beautiful are thy feet." This is Solomon speaking. "How beautiful are thy feet with shoes, O prince's daughter. The joints of thy thighs are like jewels, the work of the hands of a cunning workman." So he's not pulling any punches now. This is his own language that he's talking in now. He's not talking in things that he's heard her say. So this is Solomon speaking. He's more intense. He says, "How beautiful are thy feet with shoes." And here, no doubt it's probably sandals. "O prince's daughter," calling her a noble maiden. So he's, you know, he said, she's wearing sandals, but if she was of nobility, if she was a queen of his, she would probably be wearing shoes. But since She's not. He just calls her a noble, meaning that the prince's daughter is a noble maiden. He said, the joints of thy thighs are like jewels, the work of the hands of a cunning workman. Said, the joints of thy thighs are like jewels, rounded like a matched set of gems put in a ring. Now, she's probably wearing one of those Eastern clothes that covers her all the way down to her feet, but he's using his imagination here. Okay. Or the work or the results of an intense or intricate, precise matching, gems. He says the hands of a cunning workman, or the hands of steadiness done with great effort to bring about these things and jewelry that you would have, because this is what he is comparing her body to, this like a piece of jewelry. And they had cunning workmen then, even then, to work out these intricate things that the kings and everything that was required for the things, especially the things of the temple. They were cunning workmen. And then, too, it says this, thy navel is like a rounded goblet, which wanteth not liquor. Thy belly is like a heap of wheat set about with lilies. So he's talking about things that he's never seen here, because she's still chaste. He's not seen her navel, I'm sure. But he's using that imagination again. So this again is the way it is. It says it's like a rounded goblet or a wine chalice or a wine glass, if you will. And they didn't have glass back in those days, so generally speaking, it would have been something that was made out of fine metal, either silver or gold or something like that. It says, which wanted no liquor. And liquor there is 4197 in the strong, and it's pronounced mazeg, mazeg. And it is a mixed wine spiced with spices and water. And thy belly or your body, basically when he talks about the torso, he's talking about the body, is like a heap of wheat. And he's associating that with a bag or a sack of wheat that's been put in a bag to that point, or set about or surrounded by lilies. And so this is, this again is how he is looking at what the Shulamite said. Well, when I turn around, what are you going to see? And so he's explaining to her what he thinks he's seeing here, what his imagination is. Then it says in 3, thy two breasts are like two young roes that are twins. He hasn't seen them, but he can say this. And that, the breast is 76.99 in the strong, and it's paps. And it is in the Hebrew, it is, in translated into English, it is showed, S-H-O-D-E. And, it says they're like two young roes or two young fawn deer that are twins. And, you know, there's nothing much prettier than a little spotted fawn. And if you you know, if you could see two of them where the mama deers had twin little ones, they would be very beautiful, very pretty. So that's the way he's explaining these things to her. And then he goes on. He doesn't stop there. He says, "Thy neck is as a tower of ivory. Thine eyes like the fish pools in Heshbon. By the gates of Bath-Rabim. And thy nose is as a tower of Lebanon, which looketh toward Damascus." So he's not really leaving anything out. He's proclaiming these things. He says, "Thy neck is as a tower of ivory." And that ivory there is 81:27 in the Strong's. And that is the word shame. And it means a tooth or a cleft or a crag. And it is identified with a place in Palestine, a place in Palestine known as Shin. So we would say long and smooth. Thine eyes are like the fish pools in Heshbon. Now, I don't know where the girl had ever been in Heshbon or not, but Solomon probably had, because
he's king.
He's king. He'd go anywhere. He'd go anywhere in the realm he wants to go. So she may not understand all this as much as he does. And the fish pools in Heshbon was clear and bright, moving waters. And of course, you know, if you're going to put fish in a fish pool, you gotta have some way that they can continue to get oxygen. So generally it is a moving pool of water where it's, they couldn't go out and get no water pump put in it. So it has to be an artesian type thing. And he says it's by the gate of Bath Arabian. And I looked that up too, and Bath there, is 1337 in the Strong. Bath is a measure of liquids. Like, you know, draw me a bath. Well, how much is that? So, you know, you got to have some identification of the liquids, or have the amount of liquids that is needed for a bath. And Rabim, was the town's name, and it was a populous gate in this city that you're talking about here, and it was for a special daughter, probably a daughter of royalty. So the gate was well known by a lot of people. I don't know if it was known by this Shulamite girl, but it was known by Solomon. And then he goes on to say, "Thy nose is as the tower of Lebanon." And that would be facing eastward in elegance toward Damascus. Because if she was looking from Lebanon toward Damascus, she would be going eastward into Syria. And so that's not really hard to understand there. That, you know, it was quite common to get up in the morning, early in the morning, and look eastward to see the sunrise, because the sunrise is many things to many people. And generally, it would tell you that you have lived to see another sunrise or another day. And people would often look east to see that sun come up because it was another day given that you know, you could have to do something with, maybe. And so that's the deal with that. And then you get to verse 5 and it says, thine head upon thee is like caramel, and the hair of thine head is like purple. The king is held in the galleries. Well, what does that mean? You know, they say things that today really don't make a lot of sense. I mean, even in the King James translation, it still don't really come out the way you might think that it would.
You sort of see the rest of them. You have a lot of trouble seeing this one.
Yeah. It says, your head upon you is like Carmel, or Mount Carmel. And the hair on thy head is like purple. It is, and she said that she told Solomon way back when they first met that she was black. Well, she was dark, dark skinned and dark headed. And so, have you ever seen a crow in the sunlight and looked at a crow? That black crow will turn a different color in the sunlight. And it's according to how much water is in that sunlight that would make a difference. But when he sees her black hair here, and it is kind of like, it shines with a royal tint, because he can see purple, and purple is the color of royalty. And so it had a purplish tint to it. And it says the king, if you read the rest of it in 6 there, no, 5, the king is held in the galleries. And the king is captivated by the ringlet scene as they're held in the galleries in paintings. He is like, he's standing in a gallery looking at these ringlets on this beautiful girl's head. And he's captivated by it. In the gallery, he can't. He don't want to move to another picture. He's seeing exactly what he wants. And that's what he's telling her. He's seeing exactly what he wanted to have. In 6. And then we get down to verse 7. It says in verse 7, this thy stature is likened to a palm tree, and thy breast to clusters of grapes. Okay, so he goes back to the breast again. He can't get away from that aspect of a beautiful woman. 7. This thy stature, this upright posture and walk that he has seen her walk, evidently. She walked trim and erect. She's like a palm tree. She has grown up straight and slender and beautiful. And when she walks, it's like fluid motion. We had a young girl in church at Wolf State. It was like that. We had a lady named Claudia Price was our piano player. And she had a young daughter when we was going to church there. And that woman could walk like a model. I don't think she'd ever done any modeling, but she could walk like a model. And it was just to see her walk, it would strike you as being something different because of the way she walked. So, I kind of, and I can't even remember the girl's name, but I can remember what she looked like. But she was, her posture and her walk was trim and erect, and thy breast to a cluster of grapes each. And in verse 80 says this, I said, I will go up to the palm tree. I will take hold of the boughs thereof. Now also thy breast shall be as a cluster of the vine, and the smell of thy nose like apples. So he said, I said, he said, in my mind I want to go up to the palm tree. I want to be within arm's length. I will take hold of the boughs. And the boughs there is 5577 in the Strong's. And it's sand seam. And that is a pointed growth for large leaves that twig out from the palm tree. Thereof, now also, he says, thy breast shall be as a cluster of the vines. And that is also for my hands to take hold of. And the smell of thy nose of apples. So he is even says your breath smells good. Your breath smells like oranges. It's not apples. There was no apples in this part of the world at that time. And it was more like oranges. When you see apples there, that was the words added by the English translators. But it was actually, I think, oranges. Because they did have oranges there. But maybe no apples. But he was even talking about our breath smell. Or that was his perception of it. And so that's what he told that lady. One last time to get her involved. Now, the Shulamite lady is speaking back. Verse 9. In verse 9, it says, the roof of thy mouth like the best wine for my beloved that goeth down sweetly, causing the lips of those that are asleep to speak. No, maybe he does go through verse 9. I'm sorry. He did go through verse 9. And the roof of thy mouth is like the best wine. This would be an intimate kiss for my beloved as yagging or fermented wine. This also looked toward getting her into an intoxicated state. When he talks about that goeth down sweetly, like if he gave her wine to drink, that it would go down sweetly, causing the lips of those who are asleep or drunken to speak. And of course, lips in a drunken state, like those that he's talking about, says or speak things more easily than at other times, because if you're in a drunken state or in a state where you have drinking strong wine, it would be easy to talk someone into something that they wouldn't ordinarily participate in. Yeah, okay. And then chapter 7, verse 10 to the fourth verse of chapter 8 is when the Shulamite rejects Solomon. I'm sorry, I put that on another page and I didn't read it when I should have read it. I should have put it there. But now the Shulamite is rejecting Solomon, and she says this to the king, of Israel. I am my beloved's, and his desire is toward me. And this is a statement of sameness. This is not someone in a drunken state. I am my beloved's. It's a fact. And a full refusal to King Solomon. Said, and his, the shepherd's desire, his wish, and his expectation is only toward me. In the verse 11 is her wish, because they're not together right now. Solomon is talking to her without the shepherd being there, because the shepherd had to go back to his flock. And so they have been apart for a little while. This is her wish. She is saying, come, my beloved, let us go forth and to the field, let us lodge in the villages. And she's here speaking as if her shepherd had heard her and was with her. And she said, let us go forth away from here into the field or the pasture. And let us lodge or abide or stay in the villages where we must feed your flocks. So she is saying, I want to be with you, and I want to go where you have to go. I want to do what you need to do to make our living, and I will help you. And 12 says this, let us get up early in the vineyard, early for to the vineyard. Let us see if the vine flourish, whether the tender grapes appear and the pomegranates bud forth. There will I give thee my loves. So there's no doubt as to which direction she's going in. She is completely rejected Solomon at this point. She said, let us get up early to the vineyards. Talking about, like Solomon says, you know, you're beautiful and you're more beautiful when your face faces the east. So she is saying, as if her shepherd boy was there with her, she says, let us get up early into the vineyards. We do not wish our love to interfere with our livelihood. Let us see if the vine flourish, or if we can have a fruitful crop, whether the tender grapes appears and the pomegranates bud forth. And the pomegranate trees in a vineyard were planted at each end of the vineyard because they budded early too. And the pomegranate buds and the blooms on the pomegranates would invite the bees and the pollinators into the vineyards to where the vineyards were produce more grapes. So don't forget that. So at the end of the vineyards, or from end to end of what they have, she said, there I will give thee my loves. And loves there is 1730 in the Strong's. And I didn't understand why loves were plural. And it means to dote or to boil. You know, you've heard people talking about doting on something. It's something that takes all of your attention. But it also is like a seething pot that boils with expectations of food or something that enlivens you as food. And these enlivenments are endearments, as they're called. And so if you go to other places in the Strong's and trace it out, it talks about these endearments. So the loves there is plural, and it winds up meaning the endearments that man and women have together in a relationship of love and marriage, that love is more than a one-faceted thing. If it was just one-faceted, it would be lust, as I said earlier on in the study. So, you know, when you go back and you really look at it and you really see what all these things, what they're saying, and what it means, that there's just more to it sometimes than just meets the eye. The endearments. And in verse 13, and of course, pomegranates and mandrakes. Here in 13, it talks about mandrake. And both of them are aphrodisiacs. They make you, they give you energy and give you the sensual feelings of love that man and wife should have to each other. And so it's, and the mandrakes is kind of like the myrrh. It's something that has to be boiled down to a steam and then reclaimed as a liquid, like you would make whiskey, for example. You know, you put it in what they call a still and distill it, and then bring it back to a normal temperature, and it will come back in form of a liquid that can be used. The mandrakes is 1736, and it's in the Strong's, and that's what it says, a cedar. And it also is a pot for boiling herbs. For the absolute act that we just mentioned, it gives a smell or an odor. And at our gates are all manners of pleasant fruits, new and old, or used and now known, and some may be unknown. But she says, at our gateways, are all manners of pleasant fruits. It's all these smells and things. And our gateways, I think, is a kind of a substitute for what we would call a honeymoon. And she says this, which I have reserved or laid up for thee, O my beloved shepherd. Don't think you can say it much better than that. So there's still three verses in chapter 8, but we don't have time tonight. But we'll finish up the chapter next week if the Lord willing. But this was what Solomon had said, and now she has turned around and made it plain beyond any doubt that she's done with Solomon. She's not going to accept his offer to be a royal. And I think that was probably that's probably the first time that he's been turned down.
Yeah, could be.
But I think this is probably part of the gist of the story. And I think that's probably part of the thing that the Lord wanted to be known in this little Song of Solomon here, to be read every spring of the year, that what God has given you, it's yours to give to somebody that you love, but that you shouldn't just give it to somebody because you can, and that you need to keep it in store until the right one comes along and not be overcome by the whims and the, because, you know, this is how Eve got involved with the serpent in the garden. She listened to his spiel and didn't do what God said to do. And so we've got one more chapter to go, but it's really been a little beautiful story. And it has been something, I think, of a great lesson. And over again, we see all these things come upon them, and they get separated, they get back together. One pulls one way, and then one other pulls the other way. And Solomon has all these riches to offer, and he has these ladies to help him try to get her involved with him and to get her into bed with him. And that doesn't work. And all this stuff, she becomes an overcomer in all this.
She overcomes temptations.
Yeah. It's the things of this world. And that's why Christ come in the flesh. He come in the flesh because he understood, as being the creator, he understood all the temptations that man and woman has to face in their lifetime. And he told the Father, I'll go pay for that with my blood. And he did. And he went and paid for it that he could look at us as if it never had happened. That all these temptations and all these things can be taken care of by the right means and the right way. So thank you for your time, and thank you for going with me over all this, because for me it's been a great thing. I didn't realize that when I started it, I said, well, how in the world am I going to get through this? You know. But with the Holy Spirit, if it's intended to be, it's going to happen.
Amen.
And so I got one more chapter to go, but so far I think I've seen quite a lot of what was intended to be said and what these people were intended to know, because when they read it to each other in the Hebrew, they understood it perfectly well. whether we might not understand it so great or not. But that's the reason I tried to make it into a playbill type of thing, to where in looking up this stuff and going through this stuff that we can see and understand and get the greater picture of what's being said there that the interpreters might not have clearly brought out, because I think they may have had the same problems that I had, even reading it in the English.
Yeah.
In that sense. So again, I've certainly, when I started, I said, man, I don't know, but it's been a story of love. And I think it's something that I needed in my time that I've faced in the last year. So it's great. Appreciate it. I love y'all. Pray for me. God bless you.